Welcome to Talk World Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. This week on Talk World Radio, we are talking about so-called authorizations to use force. Brett Hines is a policy researcher and freelance writer based in Washington, D.C., where his work focuses on economic justice, political inequality, corruption, and U.S. foreign policy. Quite a lot. He is currently the Global Policy Coordinator for Economic and Climate Justice at the American Friends Service Committee, AFSC, and you can find his writings at bretthines.com. Brett Hines, welcome to Talk World Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Thanks for a recent article you wrote called Proposed War Authorization Could Allow Trump to Target 60-plus Countries. Does not sound good. Let's start with the basics. For those who don't quite know, what is a war authorization and how does it relate to a declaration of war?
That's a good question. Traditionally, Congress, whenever they have decided to go to war, would issue a formal declaration of war. But we haven't actually done that since World War II. More recently, it's far more common for Congress to pass what is called an authorization of the use of military force, sometimes shortened to AUMF, which is essentially a law saying that a president within certain circumstances, in certain conditions, has the ability to engage in hostilities, which generally means the waging of war. Right now, we have three of these that are still in effect, AUMFs. We have one still from 1991 in the first Gulf War, and we have a second one from 2002, which explicitly authorized our invasion of Iraq after 9/11. But most significantly is the 2001 AUMF, which is a very broad piece of legislation enabling the president to go after anyone who is planned, authorized, committed, or aided, quoting there, the September 11th attacks. And because it had no expiration date on it, it had no restrictions geographically on where it could be used, this has been a very abused piece of legislation. It was passed at the time with near unanimous support in Congress, everyone except one member, Barbara Lee, who stood pretty consistently for peace during her time in Congress. But its use has gone far, far beyond what Congress originally anticipated it to be used for. As of right now, this 2001 AUMF has been used to justify U.S. interventions in 22 different countries. Most notably, the ones that are most discussed are Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Pakistan, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen. But none of the language in this 2001 AUMF actually applies to what the Trump administration has been doing recently in the Caribbean, where there have been so far about four airstrikes on boats that have been accused of, without significant evidence in most cases, accused of narco trafficking. And usually the Coast Guard would just interdict one of these ships and launch a formal investigation. But now it seems that we are just blowing them out of the water. And there isn't really anything in any of our existing AUMFs that provides the White House with the authority to do this. And they seem to know it because whenever they're talking about it with Congress, they seem to be saying, oh, under Article 2 of the Constitution, we just kind of have a broad ability to do this whenever we want. And I think they know that that's kind of weak footing. So they've been looking for new war powers. And that's sort of where this story kicks off.
I know you probably can't say this in Washington, D.C., but for an ordinary human reading the U.S. Constitution, that seems to suggest that the Congress must decide on each particular war for a limited period of time. Isn't there something dubious about the whole idea of here, Mr. President, you can decide for yourself any wars by the dozens as long as they're sort of this kind of flavor of war? And to say that Congress didn't anticipate that that would result in tons of wars suggests maybe poor anticipation skills by Congress.
I would agree. I think it does say something about a lack of creativity in imagining how the White House might use something. Particularly, the big problem with the 2001 AUMF is that there's just no restrictions on it, and it can be used against so many different forces for so many different reasons when you stretch the interpretation of it. So over time, I think that Congress's realization of this has become more acute. There have been a number of attempts at repealing some of these AUMFs. Generally, the 2001 AUMF, the largest is actually been the hardest to try to get efforts to repeal through Congress. But they haven't brought any repeal effort through both houses of Congress yet, even though there now seems to be a growing bipartisan realization that it was probably a bad idea to say that any president can at any time go into any nation and launch any kind of military activity against anyone even kind of related to Al Qaeda or the perpetrators of 9/11.
And how does all of this, I know you definitely cannot say this in Washington, D.C., but how does any of this relate to treaties that under the U.S. Constitution are the supreme law of the land, such as the U.N. Charter, that say you can't start wars? I know we're supposed to believe that if Congress starts wars, they're totally legal, but there isn't any treaty that says, oh, but it's okay if you're a legislature. A crime is a crime is a crime. So, how under international law can the Congress say to the president, feel free to launch wars of this variety when war isn't legal?
I think that question kind of gets to the heart of Washington, D.C.'s unwillingness to seriously grapple with international law or to even pretend that we are actually under obligations to international law, which, as a matter of fact, we are. As the world's most powerful country, we kind of just seem to brush these concerns off. At least in the run-up to the Iraq War, there was an attempt to pretend that we were making a justification to the UN before our invasion. But more recently, through both the Bush, Obama, Biden, and Trump administrations, any attempt at seriously trying to make our foreign interventions comply with international law has just been completely ignored and thrown out the window. And it really brings one back, as much as one would like to point to the extremity of the extent that Donald Trump is taking this to right now. It makes one think of John Bolton's statements, I think in the 90s, saying that for the purposes of the United States, there is no United Nations. If the United Na Dave Chappelle would say, if the United Nations wants to come stop us, then they could send their military in and do it. These are jokes, or that was a joke at least, that is quite seriously the understanding that Congress has of international law, which is to say, we're not even a member of the International Criminal Court. How are you going to hold us accountable under any of these laws? So, to answer your question more directly, this isn't really consistent with international law, and I don't really think that any lawmakers in power are concerned about making it so.
I'm afraid you're probably right. We're speaking with Brett Hinds, who is the Global Policy Coordinator for Economic and Climate Justice at AFSC. But isn't there a big push in the House now to repeal some of these old ones? And is that directly related to a push to create this crazy new one that you've written about?
There are a couple of attempts going on right now, kind of in different ways. So just last month, the House actually passed again by a broad bipartisan majority, piece of legislation that would have gotten rid of the 1991 and the 2002 AUMFs. And those were the two that authorized our invasions of Iraq. Congress in general seems to be aware that these are very outdated. We are well beyond the point at which these would have been intended to be operational. So there is significant interest across both parties in Congress in repealing these. Repealing the 2001 AUMF has been much more difficult, precisely because I think members of Congress are aware how much every White House in modern history has relied upon it to conduct a global war on terror and increasingly other global wars, a global war on drugs, which is what we're starting to see right now. But amidst all of this, I think the Trump administration has realized that it obviously does not have legal authority to do what it is doing right now, which, for context, has been a series of airstrikes on civilian boats in the Caribbean, which have been accused of, in most cases, without any evidence whatsoever, narco trafficking. In reality, the evidence for this, for all except one of the boat strikes, is pretty thin. They've only provided evidence of narco trafficking with one of the four so far airstrikes that they've had. And in other cases, the boat is consistent not only with what one would expect of drug trafficking, but also of migration, of regular fishing expeditions, of any kind of activity. But the Trump administration seems to realize that legally it has overstepped its authority in just randomly just taking lives in the Caribbean. Many would call it murder. I would consider myself one of those many. And they realize that if they want to continue to do so, especially without triggering other legal provisions limiting the amount of time that the president can do something like this, they need new war powers. So there's been a proposal, which is what my latest article was about, floating around now for several weeks here, through both Congress and the White House. No one is sure exactly where it comes from, and I think that's on purpose. But it seems to be the rumor is some sort of collaboration between White House officials and a Republican member of Congress, Corey Mills from Florida. And this new proposal, somewhat based on the 2001 AUMF, which has caused us so many problems, and it says the president has broad authority to go after any narco terrorist, which is to say, any terrorist designated organization that is involved in any way with the drug trade or even financing it or even is attached to it loosely, which sounds perhaps like it could be a reasonable proposal. It doesn't to me, but I could see how someone might think that that would be a reasonable proposal until one actually starts to look at the scope it offers. Some people might remember that earlier this year, the Donald Trump administration greatly expanded the list of organizations designated as terrorists in the United States to include a lot of major Latin American cartels, including the Sinaloa cartel, which is arguably the most powerful drug cartel in the world. Under the language of this proposed AUMF, the president would have the authority to go after any of these organizations anywhere that they operate. And the point of my piece was to say, okay, exactly how much power does that give the president? Exactly where are all of the places that all of these different so-called narco terrorists are operating? And what I found is that it's nearly a third of all countries on the planet. Virtually every single country in the continental Americas, along with large swaths of Asia, Europe, and Africa, the president would have the ability to go into any of these countries without additional permission from Congress and begin essentially warfare against any sort of narco trafficking operation involved with one of these organizations. And this is sort of setting us up for yet another repeat of the 2001 AUMF. That, although in fairness, this proposal does have a time limit on it, a 5-year time limit, the fact that there's no geographic restrictions and the scope is so broad makes it an extremely dangerous proposal.
I couldn't agree more. I remember when President Obama was blowing people up around the world with missiles, and there was a liberal law professor who testified before Congress that if some of those drone strikes were not part of a war, they were simply murder. But if they were part of a war, then they were totally fine and legal and lovely. And she didn't know whether they were part of a war or not, because that depended on a secret memo that Obama was keeping in a desk drawer somewhere. I mean, that seems like incredible, almost unlimited power right there. But to now pass this thing you've written about that essentially declares war on any nations, organizations, individuals, whatsoever that the president declares are part of a war, then murders become legal as part of a war. And nobody ever asks what makes the war legal. And so, I mean, where are any limits after that?
This is a very interesting question and a very hard one to answer, particularly because I think in foreign policy for quite a while now, we've been seeing presidents push the limits of what the law allows them to do. And the law in this case, I'm referring to domestic United States law, since international law clearly is not a major concern. We've been seeing this growth of the imperial presidency for quite some time now, for really over half a century. But it has been supercharged by the war on terror and the new authorities that were provided to the White House because of the war on terror, where presidents now kind of have the ability to go in and kill someone and then come up with a justification for it afterwards without any real consequences for the fact that because they did this without any justification, under their own rules, it is an act of murder. And there's no real appetite for accountability, it seems, within Congress for this kind of behavior. Congress seems to be very nervous about taking its actual constitutional responsibilities seriously in terms of setting the guidelines for what U.S. foreign policy is, and they've been increasingly willing to just let whatever president is in power at the moment decide what the rules are. And when rules can just change whenever someone wants them to change, they're not really rules in the first place. So the role of law in all of this is getting increasingly murky. And kind of post facto justifying any sort of activity they'd like to take. But we're now seeing this under the Trump administration spread out beyond foreign policy to domestic policy as well. The actual limitations that the law places upon what the executive can do when it comes to authorizing the National Guard to deploy somewhere or engaging in acts of hostility, some might say, within our own border. They've been pushing this line further and further over the last several months of the second Trump administration. And we haven't really found any point yet where either the courts or Congress pushes back significantly, which is a very dark path for us to be on.
In fact, hasn't Trump declared that migration by individuals is a military invasion in order to justify a state of emergency, in order to justify kidnappings and deportations, which doesn't make any sense at all to me. But if the Congress is giving authorizations for the use of military force against organizations and persons, it starts to make a little bit more sense if war is turned into something that can be declared on a random group of guys, right?
It broadens what I mean. What we're talking about now wouldn't really even fit into a traditional 20th century definition of war. I don't know what they'd call it, irregular guerrilla warfare tactics, state terrorism, some would probably call it. But traditional warfare is kind of out the window here. I think a lot of this has its roots in the war on drugs, which just even on a conceptual level really started to introduce us to the idea of launching a military campaign against a concept or against a class of objects rather than a specific state target. And the war on terror brought this further by bringing into our scope a specific set of organizations and tactics. You know, terrorism is not a group of people. Terrorism is a tactic that can be adopted by any group of people. So when you start normalizing this idea of waging war on concepts, all of a sudden it gets so much easier to justify any kind of violence that the state might want to justify. And what we're seeing here is with this new proposed AUMF that has been floating around yet not formally introduced, what we're seeing here is a new merger of these concepts of the war on drugs and the war on terrorism through this idea of narco-terrorists. Now, narco-terrorist is actually a very controversial phrase. It's a controversial concept. Since the 80s, there have been people, even within the United States defense community, saying that it is kind of an incoherent label. You're just sort of slapping it on to groups that kind of engage in drug trafficking, but mostly are terrorists, or kind of engage in terrorism, but are mostly just drug trafficking, and trying to blend those two concepts together until you just have one big bad guy label. And anyone who's kind of involved in either of those things can be thrown in this bad guy label. And under this new AUMF, the president would have the ability to just list any organization he would like as a foreign terrorist organization under this criteria, and then go to war with them immediately without congressional approval. So it's really, I should note during all of this that this AUMF proposal has not yet gone anywhere, and it would be very difficult to pass through Congress. So hopefully we will not be seeing this move forward, but it serves as a very dark omen of the direction that a lot of militarists in Washington, D.C. would like to see the war on terror and the war on drugs take.
Very, very frightening. A recent book I read about Fort Bragg and U.S. Special Forces made pretty clear that here is, if it exists anywhere in the world, a group of narco-terrorists. And I don't know how you can define terrorism to not include blowing up boats in the Caribbean. And if you're going to blow up boats in the Caribbean and push all kinds of snake oil remedies on the U.S. public as health policy, I don't know how you're not a narco-terrorist, if there is such a thing. It seems a very, as you say, a very strange concept. But I want to ask about something else related to war powers, and that is the War Powers Resolution of 1973, which for decades a single member of the House or the Senate could force a vote in 15, 18 days, could force a vote, yes or no, on ending a war. Even if it had been authorized by an AUMF, they could end a particular war, or at least get a vote that tried to, right? And there was lots of these votes, and they never passed up until Yemen. And then Trump overruled that with a Trump vetoed it, and they didn't overrule the veto, and they didn't bring it up again because Biden was president. But now you have in the Congress at least two war powers resolutions that say no war on Iran, and one very recent on Venezuela because of blowing up these boats. And you have a Speaker of the House who says, oh, well, I just won't hold votes on those. even though the law is thou must hold a vote on this. Is anyone concerned that Mike Johnson is, as far as I can tell, illegally disallowing votes that the War Powers Resolution is supposed to mandate?
Yeah, well, I'm concerned, and I think you're concerned, and perhaps most of our listeners are. Maybe not enough people, I think, are concerned. And you bring a good point. Earlier this week, Congresswoman Ilhan Omar introduced a War Powers Resolution that would explicitly bar the president from engaging militarily in Venezuela. And I should note that the assault on Venezuela, which has been a long-going part of U.S. foreign policy, is a big component of this new AUMF, particularly given the fact that the Trump administration has been trying to tie the Venezuelan government to a number of different drug cartels operating in the region. Some real, some largely kind of fake. You'll hear sometimes talk about a cartel of the Suns, which many analysts don't think actually exists outside of, you know,
run
the CIA
by the
headquarters.
President of Venezuela, right?
Yeah, they argue that there is a cartel essentially in the upper levels of the Venezuelan state run by Maduro himself, President Maduro of Venezuela, and that this is can be used as a justification for military intervention on these on these grounds. Obviously, it's all kind of weak and flimsy from the ground up, but I think it makes it all the more important for proposals like Congresswoman Omar's to get a fair hearing in Congress. And I think that there is kind of a bipartisan coalition in Congress, and there has been for quite some time now, which is very hesitant to use its War Powers Resolution acts against the White House, particularly because of the fact that it would require Congress to take a much more active management role in foreign policy in a way that they've been willing to just leave to the White House for so long now. But under the War Powers Resolution, the president is forbidden from engaging U.S. troops in a conflict for more than 60 days. And there's another 30-day wiggle room there for withdrawal. But basically, there's a time counter that comes down for when the president is allowed to do something like these airstrikes in the Caribbean. And it seems now that it would be either November 1st or December 1st from the first of his strikes that this would really start to come into effect. There's been a long legacy of people accusing presidents of breaking the War Powers Resolution and it all not really going anywhere. But that sort of comes back to a theme that I think we've had throughout this interview, which is that so much of this is caught up in the legalism of what the rules say and what the rules are. But at a certain point, that doesn't even matter that much when you just have a presidency that's willing to break rules, when you have a congressional leadership that's willing to break rules. And at a certain point, the rules don't matter because the rules are just made up by those in power. And I think that's the real threat underlying a lot of this here. And this new AUMF is just kind of one piece of that larger phenomenon that we're seeing, in that it would give the president sort of unprecedented powers to make up the rules as he goes along.
I agree. But I'm afraid that people don't quite get always the details of what's happening. And good peace groups are now working on building the lists of co-sponsors of these War Powers resolutions as if they were ordinary bills, rather than sitting in and shutting down Speaker Johnson's office until he holds the vote as required by a single sponsor of one of these bills, right?
Yeah, I think that there might be something for, and this applies to these War Power resolutions, but also I think could be a tactic that we see more in Congress in coming years, given how gridlocked it is. The discharge petition going on right now to release files on Epstein. There's been a bipartisan group, now a majority of the House after these recent special elections, who are willing to put their name on a discharge petition that basically says Congress has to vote on this proposal to release additional files on serial abuser Jeffrey Epstein. House Leader Mike Johnson is not a fan of this proposal, but he seems to be begrudgingly accepting the fact that he doesn't really have any option except to let them do this once they have the votes. So we might have to see a situation where, in order to get things like this moving, you have to build coalitions to, but even before supporting the bill, just supporting the ability of the bill to get a vote. And it comes back to a lot of confusing congressional procedures that really shouldn't be necessary in the first place, because the fact of the matter is that when a member of Congress introduces a War Power resolution, it should get a vote regardless.
We've got just a few minutes left, Brett Hines, and It occurs to me that one thing that Congress could do about any of these wars would be to not throw $1 trillion into the war machine every year. And what I've wanted for years was for some Congress member to try to organize their colleagues to actually vote no, to withhold their votes on the policy votes on every chance to block the thing, unless the number goes down instead of up. And I got this email from Congressman Ro Khanna saying just that. And then I discovered that the darn bill had passed in the House like 3 hours before he started organizing against it. And I'm thinking, why not in the coming year try that before the vote, maybe like 11 months before the vote? There's no surprise that that it's going to be a gargantuan amount of money, right? So is there any chance at all?
Yeah, I think there is a chance, but it is going to require, kind of as you've said, a lot of forethought, particularly because in order to get people around, there has, as I mentioned before, there's a bipartisan pro-war coalition in Washington, D.C. And I think that we are starting to see some of the fragments of what could become a bipartisan anti-war coalition. And that's going to involve bridging a lot of people with different backgrounds, a lot of different ideologies. And because of that, it's going to require a lot of coordination and planning in advance rather than 3 or 4 days ahead of the vote, just saying, by the way, we should vote against this. But I think that now that we are hitting this point of a literally a $1 trillion defense budget, which is what we are probably projected to get this year between the reconciliation bill and the new military budget.
Literally a $1 trillion war budget, just to use the proper term.
Yes, I forgot. It's now the Department of War. I should keep up with my terminology. A $1 trillion war budget. If that doesn't start ringing alarm bells in people's head, I don't know what should. Because the fact of the matter is, the United States is not at war right now. We are not engaged in any, or well, we are not officially at war right now. The United States is always kind of at war in ways that it will sometimes admit and sometimes won't. But it's not like we are in the middle of Iraq or Afghanistan or Vietnam right now. There is no military campaign that the public is aware of and is behind in any sense. So this idea that we need to be giving unprecedented amounts of money, basically to serve under this administration as a slush fund for any kind of military activities he might want to engage in, should be extremely alarming to every American. And it should be something that could be organized around in order for us to start thinking about what a peaceful foreign policy would look like.
Very well said. Couldn't agree more. We've been speaking with Brett Hinds. He is Global Policy Coordinator for Economic and Climate Justice at the American Friends Service Committee. Brett Hinds, thanks for what you're doing and for coming on Talk World Radio.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was great.
This is Talk World Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. Read or listen to today's Peace Almanac entry at peacealmanac.org. All past shows can be heard at talkworldradio.org. Talk World Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way.